Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This, in honor of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services Chief Seema Verma, this is the Unleash the Data Show.
Data.
We're going to take a short commercial break while Rick and I straighten out a few things, I might add. At any rate, with it, we'll agree to disagree and we'll move on. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and a special radio wave to the MSU Ronald G. Eaglin Space Science Center. My co-medical host, Shelley Irving, is still over in Isonville, closing down our Isonville Bureau this week. But with us...
How long is it going to take to get that thing closed?
Well, there are a lot of employees right now. We're doing layoffs, and it's they're taking it pretty hard. You know, you work for
Health Matters. Give them a 12-week buyout package or something?
At any rate, to explain to you other issues other than the Isonville Bureau, from the University of Kentucky, Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the show. Not sure why you'd want to, but if you do want to, WMKY.org. That's Morehead State Public Radio's website, WMKY.org, Morehead State Public Radio's website. There you'll find a list of all the shows, and in that list of shows, you'll find a link to the audio. It'll have a summary. Certainly go in there, look at it, figure out which one you want to listen to, or just listen to them all. That's the one-way communication style that is radio. But you know what? We live in the modern age. There comes a time where we'd like to have two-way communication. So facebook.com/HMRadioShow is where you will find our, it sounds bad to say, the fan page. Isn't it bad talking about having a fan page?
People like it.
We think.
No, we have actual record. They like it.
Good point. They actually do like it from time to time. So anyway, it's facebook.com/HMRadioShow. There you can interact with us. You'll see things that are in the shows, out of the shows, in the news, things that are relevant to the time. Certainly you can ask questions, get feedback. I mean, if you know Facebook, then you know how much interaction you can do. I will say we don't have robots. We don't have auto attendants. We don't have cyber answering services. You get Tony, you get Rick, you get Brian, you get the crew. So when you get a response, you'll get it from us. So again, that's all can be found at facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
And by the way, speaking of our webpage, I did get a response at work. Somebody emailed in to my appointment schedule and said we aired a couple of weeks ago an encore presentation of our Chigger show that featured Rick belting out the Chigger song. You may remember that, Rick, one of your favorite shows.
Yeah, I wish we wouldn't have run that one.
At any rate, this person said that they had some luck with Chigger X, which is yet another product. Most of these will have some form of benzocaine. It is Chigger season, and I'm using some of the Solarcane sunburn spray. Again, it's something just to numb them up. You know, the problem is you've got Chiggers and you think, all right, I'm doing well. I've been at work all day. You come home and your mind is at ease and all of a sudden the itching starts and I need something for that before I just scratch holes in my shirt. And I find that using some benzocaine or lidocaine spray seems to be helpful. Also, there are lots of other things, menthol, eucalyptus and things like that, other Chigger products, but none of them seems to shorten my misery any. They just sometimes temporarily relieve itch, but that's another thing. But at any rate, you can respond on the webpage or you can just shoot me an email at the appointment scheduler at St. Clair.
So you're either going to get a response or an appointment.
Yeah, and they just ran that one through to me. I am, speaking of the webpage, I am in the process of starting up a new job. I have not figured out how to nap in the back room yet, and I actually have to show up for work most of the day. So my contributions to our webpage have been light, but rest assured, we are in fact back to recording live shows, and we welcome our listeners. Our sponsor for today's show, a cancer screening quiz. I copied this and modified it slightly from Medscape, which is one of my medical news feeds, and they published it August 18th. And there are 5 cancer screening questions, and we're going to go through these 5 cancer screening questions.
Three times.
We're just going to do one question right now, because because we're already halfway through the first segment and haven't talked about anything worthwhile yet.
But we never do.
Good point. The first question on our cancer screening quiz, which of the following is accurate regarding the U.S.
A.
Preventative Services Task Force, you're wrong, recommendations for cervical cancer screening, that is, what do we do for pap smears? There are four possibilities. I'm going to read all four before the rest of you ring in. Rick, of course, his buzzer has been silenced because he gave the wrong answer.
Does it make sense that I don't win a lot at Jeopardy?
Number one. Women aged 21 to 30 should be screened for cervical cancer with the HPV testing alone or in combination with pap smears. So that's number one. If you're 21 to 30, should you be screened for cervical cancer with HPV testing alone or in combination with cytology? Answer number two, initial screening should begin at age 19. Number three, screening with a pap smear every 3 years is recommended for women aged 21 to 65. And number four, women who have had a hysterectomy and who do not have a history of cervical cancer should still have pap smears. So again, one is women aged 21 to 30 should be screened with HPV alone or in combination. Two, begin at age 19. Three, pap smear every 3 years between 21 and 65. And four, if you have a hysterectomy, they should screen anyway. The correct answer, unlike what Rick said, answer number three. I'll read this. This is a correct one. Screening for cervical cancer with a pap smear every 3 years is recommended in women ages 21 to 65. Now, if you look at the other ones, if you are 21 to 30, you should not use HPV testing. HPV testing is to see if you have cleared HPV, and in many cases, women who are just starting to become sexually active may test positive, but it doesn't mean anything. So it is recommended you have pap smears in the 21 to 30 range, and then after 30, you can get HPV testing. Secondly, beginning at age 19, no, begin at age 21. Cervical cancer is a cancer of younger women, but it is also very slow growing. No need to begin until age 21. Answer number four, if you have a hysterectomy, you should still have pap smears. The answer is no. If they take out your cervix, it is time to stop testing your cervix.
Well, you're probably not going to get cancer of the cervix if you don't have one, right?
If you don't have a cervix.
I mean, that is a pretty,
right.
Even a guy like myself could make that assumption, right?
You are correct.
What did you just say?
I don't know.
Say it again. Come on.
No, I won't.
Brian, repeat that. No. Roll that tape.
You are correct. Point is, Rick is making a good point. If you had previous cervical cancer, no matter what surgery you've had, you're going to have to monitor that. That's too dangerous not to monitor. But if, in fact, they took out your cervix that was not related to cancer, you don't need to continue to get pap smears. So the U.S. Preventive Services just issued a new set of guidelines for testing for cervical cancer. They were published in the AMA Journal. And I just picked them up actually this morning. Women aged 30 to 65 can choose between HPV testing every 5 years. It's still a pelvic exam, but you can do it every 5 years, or getting a pap smear every 3 years. They said you could do both if you're just one of those kind of people that like suspenders and belts at the same time as well. But really, you could do HPV testing every 5 or pap smears every 3. Again, 21 to 30, you got to do the pap smear. The HPV testing is not recommended for younger women. But once you get past age 30, you can choose to do HPV testing every 5 years rather than a pap smear every 3. And no one is recommending an annual pap smear. This is a very slow-growing cancer, and there is no need to go through the discomfort of an annual pap smear. This is our cancer quiz. That was question one. We'll have a couple of questions in our next fractional portion if we get to it. Maybe we will. Maybe we won't. We don't know. Rick, I had a couple of stupid things, but I found something that really intrigued me from August 16th from the magazine Gizmodo, which I don't regularly read, but I saw a blog.
Sounds like
there.
The name out of a sci-fi robot.
Yeah, it's one of those computer geek things. I'm sure you're all over them, but I don't read that.
Do
kind
I
of
look
trash.
Like a computer geek to you? I've known you for close to 30 years. The one thing, I'm appalled that you would call me a geek. I'm appalled that you would even consider that.
To your face, yeah, I know. But behind your back, I say a lot of
stuff. How many times have I had to explain to you that in my early years, I was a power nerd? I wasn't a geek. Geeks are different. I'm not a geek.
Are you just trying to run out the first segment?
Is it working?
With all this, I mean, these declarations. Well, let's just get... let's try to get Rick back down to earth with the rest of us. There was a newspaper article from January 5th, 1961. At that time, I would just freely say, I was 4 years old. Rick had not been invented yet. And there was a speculation about the medical advances the world would achieve by the year 2000. A guy named Matt Novak put this on his blog. You can look it up. And he has six things here that were expected. In 1961, they thought would be accomplished by the year 2000. And so the Associated Press science writer John Barber did an interview, and he wrote it in 1961, and then Matt Novak unearthed it, and he published it. So the first thing, human beings will be able to take a pill to sleep for 36 hours and then be refreshed to last a full week until they have to sleep again. Now, you know, we've got sleeping pills, and we may be able to talk to them about them later on in the show.
36 hours is a long time.
It is a long time to sleep. We also have modafinil, which is a medicine that helps you stay awake for several days in a row. Again, our pilots are using that, but we did not get the sleep for 36, stay awake for whatever 5 days, 100 and change.
Okay, that was an idiotic thought anyway.
Okay. The common cold will be nearly non-existent.
Can you imagine having to deal with somebody who's been up for 5 days?
I think I am.
All right.
School Touché. Started, and Touché. Rick's in a bit of a mood.
Today was the first day of class, so yeah. I've had a day.
Rick, the internet at UK.
It's not the internet.
Sorry.
The internet worked wonderfully.
The Wi-Fi system at UK was tested today.
Well, it was the first day back, and we required people to actually log in as opposed to just get free Wi-Fi.
Prediction number two, the common cold will be nearly non-existent. Well, of course, we've made very little progress.
When was the last time you had a cold?
I don't know. I don't really.
Sounds like we're doing pretty good.
Well, you know, there's zinc. I mean, you can use zinc, and it will shorten your cold by a few days.
I think you're giving this guy down the road.
But zinc also causes a lot of nausea and stomach distress, and which can be as bad as the cold. So, actually, I do not recommend zinc, although some people do as a way of shortening a cold. But in terms of non-existent, I think people still get colds.
Please tell me we're going to carry this over into the next fractional portion.
No, I've got four more.
No way. No way. No way.
We've got 30 seconds. This one, I'm just going to say it in the last 20 seconds, and you'll see it. Physicians will monitor sick patients with tiny radio and measuring devices taped to their chest, which they'll watch as the patients go through the week to alert them of changes in their conditions. Well, we got pretty close to that. I mean, yep. Fitbits are pretty close.
Well, lots of ways.
Yeah. Speaking of pretty close, we're pretty close to taking a break. Why don't you take a break as well and come back for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I was going to say something about Tony, but you know, I thought, I like this dude. I'm not going to do it.
And I'm Tony Weaver.
I'm Rick Phillips.
This is the Unleash the Data show.
Data.
We're doing our cancer screening quiz. We're not going to repeat question one, which was about pap smears. And again, begin at age 21, the regular pap smears until age 30. And at age 30, you face a choice. You can go with the HPV testing every 5 years, pap smear every 3 years. Or if you're really, really concerned about it, you can do both of those every 5 years is what the latest recommendations from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommend. Stop at age 65. If your pap smears or your HPV testing has been normal, stop at age 65. Or stop if you've had a hysterectomy and it wasn't for cervical cancer. But the second question is about lung cancer screening. Which of the following is accurate regarding the Preventive Services Task Force recommendations for lung cancer screening? Item one, lung cancer screening should be discontinued once you've stopped smoking for 15 years. Item two, combination of chest x-ray and sputum cytology is what's recommended for lung cancer screening. I can't even hardly say that. No, that's wrong. Just don't do item two.
I wasn't listening to you.
Okay. We have worked so hard on low-dose CAT scans for lung cancer, I'm embarrassed to say item two, and I'm just not even going to let it stand. Item three, lung cancer screening should begin at age 40 in people who have a history of smoking. And item four, Every other year screening recommended in adults older than age 40. And the answer is actually item one. You should discontinue it if a person has not smoked for 15 years. The original study was done in people ages 55 to 75 who had smoked a pack a day for 30 years or more and had quit less than 15 years, and they found a survival benefit. Medicare will pay for it up to age 77 because the study went over 3 years, and so you extend from 75 to 77. But you have to have smoked for a pack a day for 30 years or more and quit less than 15 years. Once you quit more than 15 years, your risk of lung cancer goes back to the average person's average smoker's risk of lung cancer is the same as a non-smoker. So item two, the chest x-ray and sputum cytology is wrong. We screen with a CAT scan, a low-dose CAT scan, no contrast or anything. You just go in and get the scan. It's a very fast test. Item three, should begin at age 40? No, should begin at age 55. That's what the study did. The problem with age 40 is you're giving a lot more radiation to a younger person, and that could really backfire on you. And item four, every other year screening, it is done once a year, and it also starts at age 55, not at age 40. So if you are 55 to 77, have a 30-pack year smoking, that is one pack a day for 30 years, or 30 packs a day for 1 year, but that's just horrible. But anyway, one pack a day for 30 years and quit less than 15 years, talk to your doctor about screening for lung cancer. People who have a family history of lung cancer, people who have more extensive lung damage are more likely to get lung cancer, and we might be able to do something about that. Then I've got one more. This is for colon cancer screening. Which of the following is accurate? Number one, screening for colon cancer should begin at age 45 years. Number two, you can do a colonoscopy or a CT scan every year in people ages 55 to 75. No, that's lung cancer screening. That's not colon cancer screening, but nice try. Number three, yearly testing testing the stool for blood in people ages 50 to 75 years is one recommended strategy. And number four, flexible sigmoidoscopy, where you look at the lower end of the colon, should be repeated every 10 years in people ages 65 to 85. The answer is number three. You start screening at 50. Now, we just talked last week that the American Cancer Society has dropped that age to 45. Their recommendation started at age 45. The Preventive Services Task Force has not reviewed it. Their age is still starting at age 50. So we may very well wind up, number one, may be true next time the Preventive Services Task Force reviews this, but as of right now, they're still recommending start at age 50. Insurance companies are still paying for average-risk people to start at age 50. It may be that average-risk people start at age 45. That may be the future of colon cancer screening because it's occurring at a younger age. Item two, again, we talked about that, colonoscopy or CT colonography repeated yearly in people ages 55 to 75. No, that's lung cancer screening where you get a CAT scan every year, ages 55 again to 77. Item three is the correct one. You can test for blood once a year, ages 50 to 75 years, and that's one recommended strategy. Again, these cancers sometimes do bleed. You're still going to have to get a colonoscopy if the test turns positive, but especially for some of my patients who are trying to avoid colonoscopy or don't have a lot of money, we can at least check the blood and see how badly they need to get one. And then four, flexible sigmoidoscopy every 10 years, 65 to 85. That's just wrong, and wrong. Flexible sigmoidoscopy is repeated every 5 years, and the age for screening for colon cancer is ages 50 to 75, not up to 85, unless you are extraordinarily healthy. So the correct answer, we screen with, we either use a colonoscopy every 10 years, a sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, or stool test every year, and that is people ages 55 to 75. That is our cancer screening quiz. We're going to have one more question. We'll do that in our final fractional portion. Now, we're back to our six medical predictions that we were supposed to get through last time, but Rick, in his obstinacy, really has really made the show grind to a halt. I mean, there is no useful information being exchanged right now.
Up until now, I haven't really said much. Up until now, I haven't really said much.
Your silence has been all that's needed to just take this show right off the rails.
Well, you know, if anybody can make me quit talking, it's you.
All right, so we're up to prediction number three, which was monitoring sick patients with tiny radio measuring devices taped to their chest, which we frankly do. That's probably as good. And he said this
Bluetooth
in 1961.
Bluetooth uses radio, yeah. Right? Wi-Fi uses radio, so yeah, you could argue that. Yeah,
yeah. He was exactly right in 1961, which is pretty darn impressive. Now, number four. Patients will be able to learn the sex of their unborn baby by the second month of pregnancy, 2 to 3 months earlier than in 1961, and they would be able to have a say in the sort of child they want.
I don't know about the latter was kind of weird.
Okay, the technology's there.
Yeah.
The technology is there. You can, you know, you could create some embryos, you could run the genetic analysis, you can have, again, some say in the child you want. We are not comfortable with that. We're not doing that.
Yeah, we're not getting into that morality question, right?
Yeah, yeah. We're right now looking at the possibility we could take the babies and eliminate a gene that causes some type of life-threatening condition, and we think, well, okay, we're looking at that, and we're trying to research techniques that would do that. You could. I mean, you could run genetic analysis on the embryo, and you could find out some of the characteristics of it. That's possible, but it's not done. Number five, major diseases will be cured. And this is a direct quote. By the year 2000, today's fearsome medical enemies, cancer, polio, heart disease, will be as unexciting as diphtheria, typhoid fever, and smallpox are now.
Well, now, while we haven't hit 100% of that, we've done some damage on that one.
Well, polio is, thanks to vaccinations,
gone.
We almost were able to eradicate it, but we cannot get the world cleared of it. But in terms of people born in the U.S., I've only seen the after effects. I've never seen a case of polio in my career. On the other hand, cancer and heart disease, number one, number two cause of death.
Yeah, but we're not even close. Cancer lumped together, yes.
Yeah.
But cancer de-lumped, so to speak, we've made some major progress on some of them.
Yeah, I think the problem was in 1961, we thought of cancer as a disease.
Correct.
And that's completely wrong.
Right. Now it's 70.
Yeah, it's all kinds of different diseases, some of them genetic, some of them environmental, some of them lifestyle, and the commonality is that, the cells undergo transformation to the point where they don't respect boundaries and they just start growing unchecked.
Right.
And there are a number of reasons that happens, and so the idea of curing cancer as a condition is wrong. And to some extent, but you're right, I mean, we've been able to push heart disease back. I still don't understand why and how. If you look at the major advances since 1961, probably treating high blood pressure has done as much to cure or to delay heart disease as anything else we've done. That's the bypass surgery, the stents,
of course,
the cholesterol drugs, and everything else.
High blood pressure treatment is really good. We're spending a lot of money to deal with some of those, but nonetheless, they're still having results that are positive.
Yeah. And number six, the article also predicted new drugs will be developed to combat pain. And unfortunately, they were absolutely correct.
We've got some great drugs.
We have great drugs to combat pain, and we have been paying for that.
Shoot, we've got drugs to combat lots of things.
We're talking about close to right around 1,500 Kentuckians a year dying because we have new drugs to combat pain.
But now,
I mean, it's not all the prescription drugs. Heroin is a big problem, but fentanyl was developed to combat pain, and fentanyl is what kills most of the overdose.
But don't you think that you could loosely, correlate, say, for instance, the purple pill? I mean, how many people got heartburn that was really painful,
mm-hmm.
and here we are generating a purple pill that, let's be honest, was revolutionary, right? I mean, people who suffer from that disease or that problem, that is a cure they can't live without.
Yeah, well, and it's odd. The whole nature has been changed. When I started practice, and certainly back in the 1960s, the response to stress was to get an ulcer.
Right.
People would get ulcers.
I mean, my grandmother had an ulcer. I mean, I heard people getting ulcers all the time.
And they would bleed, and people would almost die from bleeding ulcers, and they would do surgery on ulcers and so forth. And we don't do any of that anymore. One, we have developed new symptoms of heartburn. And it seems that acid reflux has really replaced ulcers as the most common stomach and abdominal complaint. The most common GI complaint is now heartburn. But then secondly, as you said, we're able to shut down stomach acid in such a way that it is very rare that a person has a serious problem with a bleeding ulcer if their clotting system is intact and they're okay in that regard. So I thought it was interesting. Six predictions, three of them right on. And three of them just completely misguided.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. Look at the, I mean, and you're going to have a little fun with this, but I think there's an analogy here that can help. The same time period. Look at what we were doing from a, not necessarily a medical, but from a technology or a space or sci-fi. There's a whole. I mean, no, we don't have flying cars. but we are really close to delivering things via some type of a flying device. We're getting look at where the cell phone has evolved, coupled with your Fitbit.
Yeah.
Right? We're not able to repair an artery with it, but we can certainly communicate. And I mean, to the point where, start looking at all the apps on your phone. Have you ever used Uber?
My son has. I have not actually ever.
So think about
that.
You're using your phone without talking a bit, and you're basically renting a ride. I mean, the things we can do with apps on phones, I mean, or devices, is just amazing. And so you start looking at kind of where they projected we'd be. There's things that we have and that were just absurd. You know, we're not going to have spaceships. But then there's some things where we hit the mark, and not only do we have them, but we got them in spades.
Yeah. For comparison, 1961, of course, Bay of Pigs, the invasion of the Bay of Pigs was an absolute disaster. But the Soviets put the first man in space on April 12th, Yuri Gagarin, and then U.S. In May, Alan Shepard. And my understanding is, for all those missions, the total technology was less than a cell phone is today.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, you know, most modern PCs have more computing power than any of the first space missions.
Yeah. So... So that's the past and the future. I want to get this in before we finish the second fractional portion, if you will please allow me, Rick.
What we need to do is we need to figure out how much has changed just in your lifetime. Tony, we need to set the date to your lifetime.
Okay, so back to 1950. I mean, 1957 was Sputnik. I mean, you know, that was basically the Cold War. It was also Sputnik. We were just starting to explore.
So you were
space.
Born in the 57 Chevy era? That's interesting.
No. I was born in a hospital.
Yeah. Well, so you think. Do you have any proof? Are there pictures?
I'm sorry. That was a good joke, and you just don't want to acknowledge it. On to Seema Verma, CMS Administrator. She was talking about the future of healthcare. There was a Blue Button 2.0 developer conference August 13th in Washington, and she mentioned this. And Blue Button, apparently, there was a Blue Button that you, if you were a Medicare beneficiary, you could click a Blue Button and you could get your data, you could get your information, I guess a PDF or a printed form of your information on Blue Button. And so they decided, gee, they have all this information, and what if we allow developers access to some of this information, again, protected so that they didn't know which patients it was, and allow them to develop some applications that would be able to allow people to interact with their healthcare data. So this, again, according to FedScoop, another publication online that I do not read, this is the quote: "We are at the beginning of what I call the digital health revolution, where we have all this data that's in digital format within the doctor's office, and we have the ability to take that information and unleash it." And that's the name of this show. She says she envisions a future for healthcare and a future for all of us where our healthcare record begins from the time of birth and collects all of our data throughout our lifetime. These longitudinal patient records would not only include information from today's medical records, but also information from wearables, claims, and genetic tests. Imagine, she says, imagine all that data aggregated in one place. And I got to tell you, I've gone back to a more full-time internal medicine practice. You may be aware, I started up a medical school campus here in Moorhead, a branch campus of the University of Kentucky. I left that in July. And started back into just trying out medical practice. And I got to tell you, Rick, one of the striking things is I'm absolutely drowning in data.
Data.
You know, if a guy's drowning, he's willing to call it whatever you want him to call it. I'm drowning in data.
Thank you. So you need some big data analytics.
Yeah, we need a way to manage it. And so I will tell you, when someone says unleash it, I said, no, please. Leash it back.
Yeah, keep it leashed.
Because right now, your numbers just come pouring
but
in.
But your problem, it's not the data that income. I mean, it's not that you've got just the data is so severely structured that's where I think you're having issues. Is there's so many rules around the data.
Yes.
If it's one thing to have data just free flowing in from all directions with all types. And that's, you know, that's just a different beast. And we see that at UK all the time with all the devices, right? So I've got machines talk in the form of data. And so we've got massive amounts of data flowing in from these machines into repositories where we have to kind of keep them straight and separate them and listen to them. Each one of them has a different way to be listened to, right? And so we can kind of build that ourselves. You're kind of dealing with data that's coming at you, and it's very structured, it's very rigid, and it's not laid out the way your eyes are set up to read it or to manipulate it. I feel for you, man.
Yeah. I mean, we have...
electronic medical records are just hard.
Yeah, we've got the documentation. Again, the average physician spends about 50% of their time on a computer doing documentation. So you take that out of my old visits where I used to just dictate a note and someone else would type it up for me. I now have to complete the note myself. Then secondly, we have a bunch of quality measures layered on top of that.
Of course.
You know, I have to check. I found out if your BMI is over 27, I have to advise you on diet. It's one of the quality measures that we check on every chart. So
remind me not to see you as a family physician, because I know what you're going to tell me.
Yeah, so you come in, and we're working together on trying to figure out your chest pain and so forth, but you've got that BMI. I have to address that. So we have so many of those things that you have to address. We have so many we're doing a lot of data entry now instead of seeing patients. And the amount of time a physician spends with a patient, the total visit time has not changed. And so, in effect, physicians are spending less time with their patients, even as the patients really need more time. And so I am not a big fan of unleashing the data. I understand what you're saying. Properly managed, then I can sit on top of this and direct the machines to do things and send me summaries that would be very helpful.
But you're not in control.
I am absolutely not in control right now. And strikingly, I thought, you know, going back to a more full-time practice, I would be deficient in my medical knowledge, which, okay, that's an issue, but actually the most important thing is I'm deficient in my computer skills for what I'm doing. We're deficient in time. We're going to come back with our third and final fractional portion in a moment. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Woo-hoo. Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Unleash the Data show.
Data.
Some people never satisfied. This is our salute to Seema Verma, the director of the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services at Washington, D.C., and her attempts to start developers working on ways to improve, really to take the health records we have now and make them lifelong, which would obviously involve both storage in the cloud so that anyone could access them from anywhere. You remember the old days, we were talking about putting a chip in people that would contain their medical records.
Yeah.
And that seems silly.
One of the things, I still think, you know, if there's somebody who's prone to losing stuff, there might still be a need to carry it around with you like that. I always thought, you know, the military using the dog tags, right? I always thought that was the one that was going to catch on, but you know, you just never know. I think now it's obviously that your records are going to live in a cloud somewhere.
Yeah, and once we get that integrated, then a lot of good things can happen. But until we do, it is a mess. Our sponsor for the final time, the cancer screening quiz. Again, I blatantly copied this. There's nothing here that I didn't copy. And this is from Medscape, August 18th. I modified it a little bit, but you can look that one up. We have gone through colon cancer screening, lung cancer screening, cervical cancer screening, and since in the interest of time, I'm going to do one more, which is breast cancer screening. Which of the following is accurate regarding their recommendations on breast cancer screening? The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, that is. Item one, annual yearly breast cancer screening mammograms recommended in women ages 45 to 65. Number two, every other year, every 2 years, breast cancer mammography recommended women ages 50 to 74. So is it every year, 45 to 65? Is it every 2 years, 50 to 74? And then digital breast tomosynthesis recommended as a primary screening method for breast cancer if you're younger than 50. And number four, MRIs or ultrasound screening is recommended if you have dense breasts. and an otherwise negative screening mammogram. The answer, number two, every 2 years, breast cancer screening mammography recommended in women ages 50 to 74. 45 is not recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. 50 to 74 is your age range where you get mammograms, and they're recommending them every 2 years for average-risk women. The tomosynthesis, the MRIs, and so forth, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says there's not enough evidence. Some people do recommend MRIs for people who have especially dense breasts, but as a screening recommendation, as a population screening recommendation, that is not recommended. That's our sponsor, Cancer Screening Quiz, and we'll get back to where we were. We were talking about Seema Verma and artificial intelligence. This came from Becker's Hospital Review, August 15th. Japan, it turns out, has a doctor shortage. Now, they are making more doctors in Japan, which is good, but they, so far, the doctors they make tend not to go to the rural areas. The doctors they make cluster in the urban areas.
Wow, that's like a problem we've never heard of.
Yes, and so what are they doing to help these rural areas? They are spending more than $100 million, which, let's face it, in the United States, that's a weekend.
That's not even a new drug.
Yeah, hardly worth worrying about. But anyway, more than $100 million to target artificial intelligence specialists and medical equipment makers. They want an artificial intelligence assisted program in their hospital. Now, the interesting thing is this artificial intelligence is not going to greet you in the emergency room, listen to your symptoms, diagnose your illness. They will automatically enter information into the patient's records based on their conversations with doctors during examinations. I talk to you, and this artificial intelligence is creating a record of our conversation.
Right. I've heard of this.
Oh, this is wonderful. Would I not love to have someone else other than me try to remember what I talked to you about the last...
And guess what? It's also recording your voice in case that the transcription is not correct. You can go back and review the actual audio.
They could also look at X-ray, magnetic resonance imaging, endoscopic imaging, and so forth, and study their DNA to help pick methods of treatment. In other words, essentially, it is a brilliant assistant to the few physicians they've got in the rural areas.
Right.
Ease the burden for doctors and nurses. Help address the labor shortfall. I don't know how artificial intelligence addresses a labor shortfall, but okay. I always thought, you know, we ought to have robots doing physical therapy because the nurses get their backs hurt every time they pick people up. We ought to just have a robot that picks people up.
But each person's different, and can the robot adapt to your size, not his?
Well, I would offer a $100 million prize to someone who could figure out how to make a robot pick people up. And we could pay for that out of disability payments for back problems. Done. I think we're finished. You want to just roll the closing theme there, Brian?
Did you just drop the mic?
Well, the participants will develop equipment for gathering data on blood pressure meters, electrocardiographs, and other devices, and that will help their diagnostic capability. And again, they had an all-time high of 319,000 doctors in 2016. That's up 2.7%. from the previous year, but they were all concentrated in the urban areas, did not work. So their idea is to feed this information into artificial intelligence and then use artificial intelligence to do something. If that sounds familiar, that's exactly what happened with Watson, the Jeopardy winner, the mainframe computer from IBM.
Right.
So it is of interest then. This is where Japan is heading. Wall Street Journal, this was August, I don't have the date, but it was August of, anyway, it was August 2018. The title of it is IBM Has a Watson Dilemma. Watson was supposed to quickly find patterns in data, match information with the latest in medical studies, deliver personalized treatment. 6 years and billions of dollars later, I've got about seven facts here. One, Herbert Chase, who was a professor of biomedical informatics at Columbia University, in 2012, he said, Watson represents a technology breakthrough that can help physicians improve patient outcomes. He has since withdrawn as an advisor because he became disappointed in IBM's direction marketing the technology. Number two, more than a dozen IBM partners and clients have either halted or shrunk Watson's oncology-related projects. Watson cancer applications have had limited impact, according to interviews with medical centers. In many cases, it just didn't add any value. Wasn't accurate, could be tripped up by a lack of data. or rare and recurring cancers, and also treatments are evolving faster than Watson's human trainers can update the system. Now, Rick, if I start criticizing a computer, Rick's going to say, well, you know, look at the people handling the computer.
Right.
A computer is whatever you make that computer.
Right. It's only as smart or dumb as the person programming.
So Watson is still a smart computer. One of the problems is Watson cannot himself or herself evaluate the medical literature. Watson cannot say this study was flawed by a lack of rigorous controls. Watson just either this study is positive or negative. That's all Watson knows. So a human has to look at the study, evaluate it, and decide that it's worth feeding into Watson, and the humans can't keep up. Number three, there is no published research showing Watson has improved patient outcomes. So you've got all this computing power, and we don't have any evidence to improve patient outcomes. Number four.
That's disturbing.
Isn't it?
That's disturbing. I mean, you would think that even the ones he worked on specifically would have had a better outcome.
Yeah.
I would have thought Watson would have said, okay, I'm looking at data coming in from all over the Northeast, and I see that, you know, this is going on, or boy, it appears like this strain of flu is going around or whatever, and make some calculated adjustments to make sure the right flu vaccinations in the right pharmacies. But no, that's not what's happening. And they're still trying to do one patient at a time.
And you would expect by this time, we would, once again, using the 1961 predictions, you would expect by this time we would be having health matters on how to keep Watson from controlling everything.
Right.
Because there's a brilliant, genius IQ, beyond genius IQ, never forgets a thing, machine that has access to all of our healthcare data. They're feeding it in constantly, plus the latest in research, and you think to yourself, maybe it's gotten too big. In fact, Watson has been fired repeatedly from clinical applications because people found that it just did not justify the price. And the price is generally $200 to $1,000 per patient, which is what IBM charges to have Watson consult. And
Does that make you feel bad? Because your consults don't bring in that much.
I don't know everything.
Neither does Watson, clearly.
Apparently. So Touchy, Rick.
You could set up a Weaver.
Yeah, I could.
I mean, really, we could build a website called Weaver. And we don't got to tell anybody there's no computer behind it.
Weaver's a pretty smart guy. Sometimes reads stuff.
And Weaver's a big data analysis system.
IBM spent $15 billion on it as of 2015.
I'd give you like $50. I mean, come on, that's fair.
Anything less than $15 billion, and I'm just not going to be competitive here. That's my bottom line asking price.
Oh, come on, Tony. Wouldn't you do it for $100 million?
Yeah. To be honest, Watson has been a dismal disappointment.
But you got to admit, Watson's pretty good at chess.
Yeah. I mean, you give him a set of data to study, and he eats it up, absolutely eats it up. The problem is, and this is a kind of a warning to us, medical practice has so many areas of gray that when you try to standardize it, either by feeding all the information into a computer or insisting that everyone gets the same care, you're going to run into problems. Now, that's going to bother us.
Right.
We've talked before, you know, my feeling about soccer versus football. You know, six referees, instant replay, action stops as soon as the play's over, versus essentially one referee who can make calls. The other referees just wave flags. Medical practice is more like soccer than football. You cannot have an instant replay and get everything perfectly right. And for that matter, if football was that interested, they'd use a spherical ball because those bounces are just hideous. They are unpredictable. And medical care is unpredictable. The biggest wild card in medical care is the patient themselves.
Or the physician.
Well, I think you might be able to standardize the physician. You hit them with guidelines. You trim them up with this unleashed data, these electronic medical records that will not allow them to order things that are not guideline approved. But the patient goes home and throws the medicine away or takes their relative's medicine or they don't take any medicine at all. Working with human beings is going to always be different than working with spherical balls.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And Watson has...
I concede your point.
Okay. Well, gee, now we got 6 minutes, and that was one of my key things.
Well, you won. You won. Get one of those throwaway articles you've got sitting over there, and we'll talk about it for 3 minutes, and away we go.
We've got plenty. But I think in summary, you can see where we are headed. First of all, the idea of the computer chip, the idea of the card that contains your medical records, cloud has now enabled us to aggregate a person's medical record and make it accessible to everybody. Not that we can do it, but that we theoretically could do it. My problem is when you throw in genetic information and monitor information and so forth, that data becomes so complex that a human being cannot interact with it meaningfully. Now, perhaps if I had an aggregate and a computer says, go ahead and treat them, I'd say, okay. Is that your final answer? And the computer would say, yes. And I'd say, okay, I'm going to go treat them. I can
lock
handle
in
that.
The answer.
Yeah, yeah. But I can't watch all, as you said, temperature trends, infectious trends, the number of tweets, the number of Google searches on influenza symptoms, plus analyze the genetic and their environmental exposures and so forth.
What if it looks at, like, you know, travel schedules? So, like, where people maybe have flight information, where these people are going to be going from this region. A lot of people are going to be going from Boston to Chicago next month. Well, whatever's in Chicago is going to end up in Boston. I mean, there's a ton of things that you could...
Well, if Watson was so smart, Watson should have predicted his own demise.
He did.
Well, he didn't say...
He didn't
tell
anybody because he didn't want to go away.
Look, we're getting $6 billion for consulting. I'm not messing with that.
Why on earth would he tell anybody that?
All right, I do have one more thing. Yeah, you're pretty good there. All right, good. So I got one more thing. I got to get in there. This is called ambient tweeting. And there's been a couple of things here that really made me
think. Is this sleep tweeting?
Yeah, well, all right, Elon Musk tweeted he was considering taking the company private, and he may have violated all sorts of rules with that. But before that, you may remember he picked a fight with one of the divers that was rescuing that soccer team over in the Far East.
I think fight's a strong word, but I know what you mean.
He called him a pedophile. He said he was a pedo. That was his word. He was a pedophile. And you start wondering, why is the president of a company picking a fight with a scuba diver who's trying to rescue kids? It doesn't make any sense. And then also, you may remember Roseanne Barr apparently tweeted a racist comment, which led, interesting enough, both of these celebrities took Ambien. The folks that make Ambien commented, Sanofi, as the people that made it, they commented that Ambien does not cause racism. Maybe not, but we have talked many times on this show about how Ambien loosens your judgment. And so it would be the sort of thing that would make you tweet some things that you very much regret if you were taking Ambien regularly. You know, it made me think, Rick, back in 1992, President George Herbert Walker Bush was on Halcyon, which was also a short-acting sleeping medicine, and the nation became concerned when he collapsed, when he vomited on a Japanese dignitary because of that. And I think we're seeing a very similar thing. I myself, very worried about Ambien, don't like that medicine, and don't like its effects on people. Sort of similar to Health Matters, which is why we need to get off the air.
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and Eric Bilby, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or just visit us on Facebook. Do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is a sedative radio show, also called a hypnotic radio show. Health Matters affects chemicals in the brain that may be unbalanced in people with sleep problems.
Health Matters may impair your thinking or reactions. You may still feel sleepy the morning after listening to our show, especially if you are a woman. Wait at least 4 hours or until you are fully awake before you do anything that requires you to be awake and alert.
In January 2013, the Food and Drug Administration lowered the recommended volume for Health Matters. If you have heard our show in the past, your doctor may direct you to listen to a lower volume of this show than you did before.
Some people listening to our show have engaged in activities such as driving, eating, walking, making phone calls or tweets, or having sex, and later having no memory of this activity.
Wow.
If this happens to you, stop listening to Health Matters and talk with your doctor about another treatment for your sleep problem.
Health Matters may be habit-forming. Boy, tell me that. And should be heard only by the person who owns the radio. Never share your radio with another person, especially someone with a history of drug abuse or addiction or who listens to Time for Tales. Keep the radio show in a place where others cannot get to it.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.